Today's subject is the musician Vivian Stanshall, who apparently sang in the womb, and of whom a clairvoyant once said that he'd either be an artist or an admiral.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums. And Sam Spoon's rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone.
Vivian Stanshall himself, stylishly introducing my guest today, Neil Innes, who played with Vivian in the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, before moving on to...
Well, I didn't actually play with him.
Thank you very much for that helpful...
We played together.
I was about to say, before moving on to find fame in the Beatles' pastiche group, The Ruttles. Neil, why have you chosen Vivian?
Well, it's so easy to sort of let these wonderful people slip by, you know, and... As the time goes by, I just find, you know, sort of, I really miss him, you know. I think the world misses him. It's such a shame that, you know, such a wonderfully dangerous person should now not long, no, you know, it'd only be left to us on record and things like that.
Describe your first meeting with him.
Well, I was at Goldsmiths Art School, and he came to a pub near on the corner, big Irish pub, the New Cross Arms. And he was slightly plump in those days, and he had Billy Bunter check trousers, a Victorian frock coat. He had violet oval pince-nez glasses and carried a euphonium under his arm. But to top it all off was the enormous pink rubber false ears.
Neil, did he have these things in a sort of box of conjuring tricks, or was he just walking around dressed like that?
No, he would have travelled all the way from where he came from dressed like that. I mean, Viv had a wonderful sense of humour.
You ever get beaten up on the underground?
No. I mean, there's something about Viv that was, you know, larger than life, and he always got away with murder. I remember once in Manchester, we just all had a lunch of, you know, the hottest vindaloo we could probably have. And he came out onto the street, and a little old lady with one of those little wheelie shopping bags. And he just dropped on one knee and sang One Alone to her. You know, One Alone is, you know, one alone to be my own, I alone to know her caresses.
How did the little old lady with the shopping bag take this?
Exactly. Anybody else would have been clouted around the head, but she said, oh, thank you, love. He said, not at all, he said. I mean, we walked on, and I just thought it was a charming moment.
Why had they called it the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band?
This is the nicest story, I think, but at one point, you know, I think Viv actually put this around, that the bits of paper were put into a hat. So Bonzo Dog was in there, along with Band, and Dada, the turn-of-the-century anti-art movement.
And Doo-Doo.
Well, no, actually, no, it should have been. But I think there were one or two other things in there. What came out was Band, Dada, and Bonzo Dog. So it began life as the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, but then it's very tedious trying to explain a turn-of-the-century anti-art movement in, you know, a sentence or two, so we just dropped it and turned it into Doodah.
Here's a clip of an interview with Vivian from 1989, looking back at those early days in the Bonzos.
We were people who were rebellious neo-Dadaists, iconoclasts, if you like. The gestures, I prefer. But the jokers in various London art schools who came together because they were dissatisfied, really, with the quietness of expression. And we had a great deal to talk about, other than... I don't really know what ordinary bands talk about. I mean, I suppose they talk about women and chords and wood and... how many ways one can wear a rat.
That's our Vivian.
Let me ask you, Neil, about how the band went from there. They soon became quite well known.
The band were playing in pubs, and then our first manager was Kenny Ball's brother-in-law, a man called Reg Tracy. And he took us to Newcastle in our Easter holidays, I think, and played a week's cabaret in Newcastle and South Shield. And it was such a hit that we ended up getting 6 weeks' work on those kind of northern club circuits. And that led to another 6 weeks and another 6 weeks. And before we knew where we were sort of like, you know, amazingly popular.
I guess that was the point then, when the band didn't go off on a trajectory that it could have, which was basically just being a kind of tribute band to traditional jazz. Kenny Ball, in some ways, did that, the new vaudeville band as well. And there was quite a public taste for that sort of thing.
There was.
What was it that you added, would you say? How was it that you diverged and so plainly did?
Well, I think it's not so much what we added, it's what we subtracted. We subtracted any bit of musicality there might have been, you know. I mean, to play jazz, well, you've got to be pretty good, but we were much more interested in mucking about.
The first big success the band had was in 1968 when they scored their own hit with I'm the Urban Spaceman.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. I've got everything I need. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I can fly. I'm a supersonic guy.
Now, I'm delighted to welcome on the line from San Francisco Vivian's second wife, Kai, then Pamela Longfellow. How did success change him?
Well, he said that there came a time in the Bonzos when it got pared down to a certain number of you. He felt so comfortable with you people that he felt that he could take risks. He felt that he could lean out across the audience and you would hold him up. And in New York City, he did that and stepped out of his body. This is what he said. This is when he panicked and began to take... He went directly to a doctor and took Valium. He was always drinking, you know that. But at this point, he began to take Valium. And the story went around and that he had been slipped something, you know, like people used to do acid or something. He, as far as he's concerned, that never happened. What he did was panic because he was flailing suddenly on stage, which he had never done before, in a psychic
That's
disaster.
Right. I mean, he used to talk to me about it. He said, you don't know what it's like, Jock, when the stage fright gets you. It suddenly turn into stage fright.
Well, that's because of what happened to him. He was in total trust, and suddenly his, I guess, ego realized he was in trouble. He was out of body, and he didn't know how to get back in. When I met him, I told him I knew exactly what he was talking about, because this had happened to me. And at that point, he cried, because he said... No one has ever understood what I've gone through and what I go through. And I said, well, it's a pity they got you stuck on Valium, because he was for the rest of his life.
How did the band break up, Neil?
Overwork.
Yeah.
5 years on the road, bought off 3 managers. I mean, 1969 was the killer year. Yeah. We'd done 13 half-hour Do Not Adjust Your Sets, made 2 albums, been to America twice, done the Isle of Wight Festival.
And you knew to split up?
We decided, let's knock it on the head while it's still pretty good.
You think you were Greta Garbo, that you'd come back one day?
No, I didn't.
Oh, because Vivian a little bit.
Well,
thought maybe.
Because I remember distinctly coming back after the last official Bonzo gig, and it was one of those things, it was wee small hours, and coming down towards London, and the sun coming up, and I'd been thinking all the way in the dark, you know, well, that's the end. That's the end of something really special. Mm. And then as the sun came up, and I thought, oh, yeah, but it's probably the start of something else. You know?
The first solo album, Men Opening Umbrellas Ahead, was released in 1974, and it was quite a departure from the style of the Bonzos. How was that received?
I was going to say that Warner Brothers, once they heard it, I guess you know, they only pressed 5,000 copies, lost one of the masters, so half of the album is on acetate, and never released it in the United States whatsoever. And Vivian, when he knew all this, became outraged and visited them in one of their board meetings, a most famous meeting.
What did he do?
He stormed into an actual board meeting and gave a tremendously wonderful speech. I didn't hear it, but I'm sure it was terrific. He was carrying with him, because he had just come from a pet shop, a jar of maggots. These maggots, these maggots were meant, of course, to feed his fish and his snakes. But when their backs were turned, he Anyway, when someone had turned their backs, he dumped the entire jar of maggots behind the hot radiator. I wouldn't have wanted to be in that office a few hours later when they all hatched. And that was that for Warner Brothers.
And around this time, he also became involved with radio. And I've got a clip here of one of his stories from Rawlinson's End, which featured a variety of bizarre characters, including Mrs. E and Old Scrotum, Sir Henry's wrinkled retainer.
By 9:30 that evening back at the Great House, dinner was finished, and the Rawlinsons and their guests lolled over the blancmange or sprawled back, blown out, picking their teeth.
That was inedible muck, and there wasn't enough of it. Blah!
The curry lay heavy on Sir Henry's stomach like a royal corgi.
I say, how dare you belch in front of my wife? Squeaked Lord Portly.
Henry yawned.
Sorry, old man, I didn't realise it was her turn.
Neil, is it true that the Old Scrotum joke was actually nicked from you?
I called Vernon Old Scrotum the Wrinkled Retainer.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no. I mean,
he never admitted that.
No, he wouldn't. No. But he was a master of vocabulary. Yeah. Mm.
You're listening to Great Lives on BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris. My guests, Neil Innes and Kai Longfellow. Neil has chosen the life of his fellow Bonzo Dog Doodah Band member, Vivian Stanshall, and Kai is Vivian's widow. So, Kai, you're now living in a houseboat painted purple and green with this extraordinary man whom you haven't known for very long.
No.
What was it like and what was he like? What sort of state was he in?
He was the sweetest, softest. Oh, he was so soft inside. I don't know if you know this, Neil, but you probably do. When he wasn't in public, which was even one other person, he was gentle, loving, sweet, adorable.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. He did have a very, very
sweetheart and
heart,
very simple. He was also an absolute idiot. He had the most ridiculous political views. And people assumed that he read like crazy, that he was amazingly well read. And they would come away from interviews talking about his amazing library. That was my library. He never read a word.
Kai gets to know him at this stage
and marries
him. You know him already, Neil, and are presumably on and off still in touch with him. How far had he fallen? Had he failed? Did he think he had failed? Did he think he was failing? Was it a happy or a melancholy picture, Neil?
It's quite a long, over a long period. I mean, what became noticeable, that his bright, illuminated periods began to dwindle and his darker moments began to sort of get longer.
Yes, but when his bright, illuminated moments were illuminated, Neil, they were brilliant.
It's still brilliant, absolutely.
Yes. Tough question here for both of you. And it springs a little bit from something Kai said earlier on about his out-of-body experiences being caused by the fact that he felt he had loyal friends in whom he could trust who would always hold him.
Yes.
Do you think that life and you, both of you, and all his friends and fate were just too kind to him and didn't give him enough of a wake-up call early on?
No. And he didn't have that many friends.
So no, this was going
I think he was always on edge.
Programmed for destruction.
Yes.
Probably, yes. A big self-destruct button.
Here's the clue to Vivian, and it was made very, very clear to me towards the end of his life. Vivian did what he thought was a lark and easy. When he fell into the Bonzos, it was a joke, wasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely.
Something you did when you weren't going to art school, when you weren't painting or doing whatever you felt that you were supposed to do. Vivian regretted not being a painter his entire life. One of the last times I ever saw him, he was weeping at his failure.
Was that regret right? I mean, could he have been a great painter?
I do think so.
I think so too.
I think he could have been something extraordinary, and he knew that, he knew it and didn't know it. He didn't believe it, he didn't trust it, and he thought going off and, I mean, it was so damned easy to write songs, so easy to ponce about in front of a band, so easy to do all these things, so he just did them, and people kept paying him for it.
There's also the, kind of, occupational hazard of being a kind of clown and everybody's sort yes. of... there's the dark side, the serious side, doesn't really get fed. Mm. And so it sort of tends to sort of swamp. It's like a malaise d'éclat. You know, the depression is there, it's part of it.
Yes.
But what you have to weigh up is the inspired comedy and mirth that he only managed to sort of infect us all with, you know.
Yes.
It was, you can't take it out away.
Kai, you had bought him a ship.
I bought me a ship, but I felt it was a showcase for him.
What was the ship?
It was called the Thecla. It's still there in the docks. It's become a legend. And we wrote there in 3 months. Vivian and I wrote Stinkfoot. We wrote it. We scored it. We rehearsed it. We organized the band. And we got it on in 3 months. I don't know how many people have put on a full-scale musical in 3 months, but we did it. But it had the most cockeyed, salty charm. It was fantastic. And people who saw it never forgot it. Never.
Neil, you and Vivian had by this stage parted company professionally. You've never worked with him again, did you?
There was one last thing we did together.
Yes.
He rang me up, came up to Suffolk. I live in Suffolk. He rang me up and I said, "Oh, where are you? I'll come and pick you up." He said, "I'm at the bottom of your lane. The taxi won't go up," because I lived up a rather rough lane that was, in fact, a river. I said, "Well, all right." But I got down there, and there he was, you know, with his long ginger beard knotted and his glass eye ring. And
that's said, my wedding ring.
Is it? Well, he was wearing it, but I said, "Well, where did you phone from?" And he said, "Oh, one of these houses." So I thought the people must have had a fit, you know. There's this strange person. May I use your phone? Because he could get away with murder. But what we did was work on this song, the last one we worked on, called "I'd Picked Up a Hitchhiker Coming Out of Leeds." It was off to a sealed knot thing, enactment of the Civil War. And I said, "Oh, which one are you, Roundhead Cavalier?" He said, "Roundhead." I said, "Are you political?" He said, "No. No matter who you vote for, the government always gets it."
Oh, great, great slumbering nation, awake, set yourself free. Oh, smell the comforting bacon, taste the bromide tea, and give a little chirrup as I ladle on the sill. Promises are cheap. Let me bear your crosses, make me boss of bosses, then you'll go back to sleep.
Hey ho! Tell me about your last years with Vivian.
Well, I waited and waited and waited. I had this crazy idea that there would come a day, like with Peter O'Toole and a few other people who drank so terribly heavily, that their doctors would told them, "You stop drinking and or you'll die." And I thought, someday someone will say this to Vivian and it will really get through. So I waited for that day. And it didn't come. And but the last time, I mean, so what I did was I couldn't wait in England anymore. My kids were growing up. Silky had never seen America. So I flew her back to Vermont. Outraged Vivian. I said, "Honey, you can get on a plane any day." "Vivian, on a plane, please." I was on a plane with Vivian. Whoa, what an experience. So basically I got on the plane and I flew back to England many, many times before he died and stayed with him for months and months and months and months. And the last time we talked was all on the telephone, and he was keeping a lot of things from me because he was dying. I mean, it's true that he died in a fire, but he was already dying because the drinking had destroyed his peritonitum, and he was having a great many health problems, and he was keeping it a secret from me. And we were talking about how he was going to sell the flat and I would move out of my farm in Vermont, and we were all going to get a place in Hampstead. This is what we were actually speaking about before he died, except the very last phone call. And I don't know whether that's not too personal to go into at this moment, but it told me subconsciously that things were very, very bad.
How?
Vivian never apologized. Not in his whole life that I can think of. He didn't apologize for big things. Little things, sure, but not big things. He apologized for everything that he ever felt that he had done to me. He did many things to me, for instance. He apologized for how he treated me as a writer. And he said, "I treated you like that because I was afraid you were better than I was." And so these kind of things coming out of his mouth sounded so kind of goodbye, darling. You know what I mean?
Neil, I'm going to lay my cards on the table here. I just don't get Vivian Stanshall. I never have. I don't find that the big pink ears funny. I don't find playing the ass funny. I quite like the music. I thought he had a rather nice singing voice. Is there something wrong with me? What can you say to that part of Britain that doesn't get it?
Well, because this is radio as well, I mean, the thing is, you can't make faces on record.
Mm.
And Viv was an incredible stage presence, very much a visual performer. And you had to have the whole package. But, I mean, he was a practical joker. And yes, he did take the easy way out. He preferred mucking about to serious work.
Mm.
I mean, heaven forbid if he'd had a streak of it in him like Proust. I mean, if Proust had sort of boiled it down to 5 pages, would any of us be any the wiser? I felt, terrible in a way, because towards the end, I had a strict rule with him. If he rang me up and he was slurring, I said, Vivian, I'm not talking to you while you're slurring. And
didn't he tell you had a cold?
Oh, he tried everything. Of course he did. But I was very firm about it. And then a few days later, he'd be talking normally, and we'd have a chat and whatever. But the very last phone call he gave me, he was slurring. And I said, oh, Vivian, you know the rules. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to put the phone down on you. And I've always sort of felt, oh, dear. For once, I could have maybe have listened. But you can't, He became like a battleship firing on his rescuers.
In a way, a great life has to be characterised by something valuable that's left behind. Are you sure he did?
Yes,
absolutely. I mean, the thing is, if it's only my memories, Viv's actual great life dwindled before your very eyes. And that's what makes it, but it doesn't take away any of the greatness from it, because he was not like anybody else. I mean,
that's it, Neil, that's it. I mean, you're saying that you don't appreciate him and you don't see, and yet there are so many people who have created so ephemeral, and yet they're so fetid, and yet Vivian has done things that have touched people deeply, deeply, much more deeply than some silly song, by some music hall artiste who we've still heard of. Vivian was, he was an absolute original. There was nobody like him. Can you think of anyone near?
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And I was just trying to think of something that was more joyful, a memory
they
of him.
They are joyful. Stinkfoot's joyful.
Yes, I know.
I don't want to keep saying it, but it's true. People don't know that he made this show.
When Stinkfoot comes out, and then the thing, that could be the thing.
I think it will show people that he was, it's all about art. It's all about the artist. It's all about, it's actually an upbeat, optimistic, joyful, chock full of songs people have never heard show.
we got one final clip here from Kai's private collection of a more private and reflective Vivian performing a song aboard the boat he was living in, Searchlight. Kai, set the scene in the boat.
This is an example of Vivian every single day. If he wasn't painting or sculpting or gardening or running around after me for various purposes, he was writing music. And we had a teeny-weeny little bird that I rescued from a horrible situation called Seedy, a little finch. And we both adored Seedy. This is Vivian's song called Seedy, about Seedy, accompanied by Seedy.
G minor, G seventh, C seventh, F. That's my F.
You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to Neil Innes, who chose Vivian Stanshall, and to Vivian's wife, Kai Longfellow, for joining us today. Goodbye.